Hello and welcome to What the Heck is Going On? Kulturwandle Dich, the podcast about cultural change and how it can actually work out. This is the second season and it's all about female leadership. My name is Markus Schaper and today we have a guest that I'm very proud of and happy of to be here again. Hi, Annemie Ress.
Hi, Markus. How are you? Also in a rainy situation, just like I am in the UK, you're in Germany.
Yes. We share the same weather, I think, in Northern Germany and in the UK quite often, I would say. And which is okay. So we have always a topic to talk about, right?
Exactly. I never thought I would because, you know, when I lived in South Africa, you basically have sunshine. But I've never spoken so much about the weather as when I came to the UK.
And it's part of the culture in the UK. I mean, not talking about the weather is almost like not talking.
It's a sin not to talk about the weather.
Exactly. I mean, why has God created weather, right? To give the UK people a topic to talk about. but that's not the only topic you can talk about or we can talk about. Let's talk about you a little bit, Annemie. And for those who don't know you, which might be just a few, you studied law, actually, in South Africa, in Witwatersrand. I don't know if I pronounced it correctly. And then you started a career somewhere between law and people management in South Africa and moved over to the UK, also as an HR manager and director for eBay, for Skype, for PayPal. And this was in the early 2000s, so these were really innovative, fresh companies at these days. At least that was my impression from looking at the outside. And then you created a consultancy for people and innovation, Purple Beach. Purple Beach is still there. It's a nice big consultancy, and the CEO and director of it, wonderful. And let's talk about that also a little bit, what you're doing there. In the meantime, funny enough, whilst you're having this consultancy, you also were the managing director at the Energy Innovation Hub and tried to bring more innovation into the energy space, which is highly valued. And that's also where we got to know each other. So it was a very nice long chapter, quite a few years. And after that, you continued with Purple Beach, but also you have advisory positions, entrepreneur and resident positions, HR director position, 8 at the same time. This must be a lot of work. Isn't that a nightmare? Oh, my God. So how are we? Now, this is a Friday. So how eager are you to move into the weekend?
I wish the weekend could start just as we finish here. But unfortunately, as you know, we have some home renovation that we are doing. So that needs work in between all of the other work. And then I have meetings on and off, in person, virtual, until this evening at about 7. So my weekend can't start. But if it could start right now, I would be very happy. So this, actually, our conversation is like a mini break for me.
Ah, okay. Thanks a lot for taking the time for that. We have a small section, also to warm up a little bit more. And how many days last week did you talk about female leadership?
Wow. Oh, actually, I would say 2 days. 2 days last week.
Any particular situation?
Yeah, it was a board discussion, and we were talking about the composition of a board, and we were discussing how the fact that if you, in very traditional industries, if you can bring in women, you do bring in a different flavor into how the CEO will react, will be open and interact with the board. So it was in that context. It was in the context of very traditional organizations and the benefits that could be brought when you bring female leaders into that mix.
We'll explore that a little bit more in detail later on, I would say, but that's a very interesting topic indeed. And last week, what was the situation where you could laugh about most?
What was the situation where I could laugh about most? I did have a good laugh. I'm just trying to remember what I laughed about. I mean, I laugh every day. I think probably with, as I said to you, we're doing home renovation. And instead of crying, I decided to laugh when things weren't going really well and they were taking longer. For one second, I was like, oh, I'm going to cry. And then I thought, you know what, just be happy, smile, it will pass and you won't remember it. It's like a painful operation, or if one is not very healthy or your tooth aches, you forget it quickly, right? And so I thought, okay, I just laughed at myself for taking it all so seriously.
Okay, nice. And who would you wish to be part of the audience of this episode?
You know what, I would like women who maybe are older and who still have a lot to offer from leadership and just from a perspective of delivering for companies, so older women. And then I would like really young women at the beginning of their careers, because I think on both fronts, there are some peculiar challenges. And I think female leaders should be helping each other a little bit more. So on the older front, I know of so many talented women who actually can't find that next role or that next opportunity. And I'm not saying it's because they're women or because of age, but I am being a bit provocative in saying I think it has something to do with that. And then if I talk about younger women, for me, it's more that I want to have realistic conversations with them. Because if there was one thing I would have appreciated when I was early on in my career, is that if someone spoke to me and said, look, you can have almost everything, but you cannot have everything. And it doesn't have to do with being a woman. It just has to do with life. And you always have to make choices. I think that is a much more realistic conversation and probably would have led to much less angst and striving for things and waste of time, frankly. So that's why I would like those two ends of the spectrum.
Okay, I hope that they're all there. Welcome. You're right.
I hope. I hope.
And we have a small kind of psychological test, if you wish. Is that
okay? I'm up for it.
It's a very, very simple one. I just read out two words for you and would like to ask you to just pick the one you prefer. Very simple.
Oh, okay, good. I like this.
Okay.
I like this.
Okay, as a warm drink, would you rather have tea or coffee?
Depends on the time of day. Yeah. What time of day is it?
Well then in the morning,
coffee,
and in the evening,
tea.
Okay, that makes sense. Somehow. Very good. And I don't ask about the noon time, but
tea okay. In the day, tea in the evening, coffee first thing in the morning.
So you need a coffee to wake up, and then from then on it's about drinking tea a little bit.
Okay. Literally, if it's only one sip, I don't even need a whole coffee.
Okay, interesting. Going out on the weekend, rather to the sea or to the mountains?
Oh, the sea. I mean, as I sit here and I'm looking out over the sea, the cliffs, stormy, the sea anytime.
Okay. As a pet, rather a cat or a dog?
Cat.
How many cats do you have?
We had two. The old one passed, and she was 19, and now we have one who we still think is small, and he's 16. But frankly, you know, we love animals, so if we can have a shelter dog, we'll love that too. But for now, I would say cats.
Cool. When you listen to music, is it rather vinyl or streaming?
I've gone back to vinyl recently. I love it. I love the warmth of the vinyl sound.
Yeah. Good. And later on, living, where would that be? Rather in the city or countryside?
See, just where I am now.
Okay. Very nice. Beautiful. Thank you for that. So
is that the psychological test?
Yes, that's the psychological test. Now we know everything about you.
Uh-huh.
I just don't know how to interpret it, but it's people like it. Let's talk a little bit about yourself. I mean, we talk about female leadership, right? And one of the components of leadership is, of course, leading self. So let's start with yourself. When you started off, you started as a lawyer, which I wouldn't have imagined if, you know, people who know you now would probably not really think that you are a lawyer by education. How did that come along?
I basically chose law because I thought that one needed a grown-up career. Now, I'm really happy that I chose law because it taught me a way of thinking. But I guess, you know, within the first 2 years that I was doing it, I was like, oh my goodness, this is so boring. And but I'm quite a determined person, so I completed that degree. But what I did in parallel, and this is actually also why I ended up doing a lot of work in Germany, I did a German honors degree in parallel with my law degree. I'd studied German at school. I was an exchange student in Austria. And actually, to be very honest with you, my German has helped me much more than my law degree. So my law degree helps me think in a very structured way. But actually being able to speak German has opened so many doors for me, both professionally, and I've met amazing friends that, and I did the German degree because it was fun, enjoyable, artistic, creative. It was literature. I love reading. And so, yeah, so that was a kind of the parallel world. And then what I decided to do was, I'll tell you more. Ask me another question. But it's law German. I actually use my German degree more than my law degree.
Okay, that's interesting. And many people who speak German as a mother tongue will probably not understand why German is interesting and sexy and everything like that. We find it as a bit cumbersome language. Quite powerful, but not easy to understand, not easy to learn, and so on. So it's why did you choose German over, let's say, French or Italian or any other of these nicer languages?
Yeah, well, I did in school. I did both German and French, and I had the choice of German or French. My mother tongue is Afrikaans, and actually for me, German is not that difficult compared to, well, the pronunciation's fairly easy, the sentence structure, the word formulation. So for me, that's why I chose it. And I think once I'd also had the opportunity to be an exchange student, I just like the culture. I like the literature, both the really old stuff. So we had to read stuff like in Mittelhochdeutsch. So we had to read like Das Nibelungenlied. Yeah, Das Nibelungenlied. And Tristan and Isolde. And so we read really very wide. But for me, because of Afrikaans, it was easier. And so, but having said that, at the moment, I'm doing one language I always wanted to do was Spanish. And so since the pandemic, I've been doing every day 30 minutes of Spanish on Duolingo, and tomorrow will be my 1,000th day in a row of doing my Spanish. And I can speak. I have my teacher in Colombia that I speak to once a week, but mainly in the mornings I do Duolingo. So I kind of went back. I love languages. I love creativity. And that's why, to your point, a lot of people will say, how did you do law? I think law gave me that balance, and it will come later to innovation, right? Because I think innovation is the pragmatic marriage of creativity and pragmatism. And I think that's where you will always see my particular approach to innovation, to life, to leadership is really a reflection of all these creative things I love doing, and then actually a very solid acknowledgement that execution and pragmatism is foundational if we want to do and really unlock both the potential in people or in business.
If you could now turn back time, would you choose law again, or what would you pick?
I probably would, you know, because I think what it does give you is when you look at careers, and when you look at, you know, if you go for an interview, or, you know, if I just had language, and I'm, you know, it's such a shame that the world is like that. And I read a really interesting article about this very topic in a second, and I'll tell you, but I think your law degree opens doors. And if I purely did language and creativity and art, I personally wouldn't have had the way in which I think so structured. And I probably wouldn't have had the opportunities that I got, because I think the law opened the door. Whereas I think it's such a shame if I just did the artistic pieces, I probably wouldn't have ended up in business in, you know, where I am today. So the law opened the door. I will probably go back and do it, but I will do it in a different way. I'll have much more fun.
Okay. What would that mean?
I won't take myself so seriously. I would, you know, I think I would, it's also about how we learn, isn't it? I think that was long, it feels like long ago. That was like, I started studying law in 89. And, you know, you had a perspective, the way in which we were taught was very different. You know, you had to learn stuff versus understanding things. And I think if I'd approached my law degree from the perspective of trying to understand versus just learning to get good marks, and not that I did get that great marks, but it's another story. But I think that's how I would approach it differently. I'd be curious.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
More curious as opposed to just learning.
Yeah. And then you moved on into your first positions, and there was always also a component of HR and people leadership in there. Why did you choose these positions?
Well, I think, I mean, in between South Africa, I also worked in Switzerland for a period of time at the Swiss Institute for Comparative Law as a staff legal advisor. And part of what I liked doing in my law degree, the subjects I liked were human rights law, gender in the law, you know, actually labor law. So always things that had to do with people, that had to do with fairness. And in a funny kind of way, for me, there is a connection between what I did in human rights law, what I did in gender and the law, and some of the topics we deal with today, right? Because mm-hmm. I think as employer, this concept of fairness is of critical and crucial importance in everything we do. So whilst I just said to my law degree, it helps me think, I also think the seeds of why I like working with people comes from, you know, human rights background. And I was very naive when I was young, which is good because you think you can change the world. But what I've realized is, you know, I actually don't think I can change the whole world. But through how I help other leaders, through how I lead, I can have an impact on people's lives. And that actually helps change the world, even if it's just for one person or someone around you. And in a funny kind of way, that goes back to my human rights stuff.
Mm-hmm. Now, actually, we're moving towards the space of innovation. And
yes,
I think, if you look from the outside, it looks like, yes, you moved to some tech companies who are doing innovation. So that's mm-hmm. probably where you first met innovation. How was it for you? How was it feeling? What's the story behind it?
Yeah, so I mean, eBay was tiny, PayPal was tiny, Skype was tiny when I joined all of them, mm-hmm. and very young companies still, not even international in the true sense of the word yet. And you know what? I think that what I enjoyed working there was innovation was in the lives lived by everybody every day, and it was part of getting the competitive advantage. It was just part of how we do things. Wasn't even spoken about, to be quite honest with you. Mm-hmm. The word was never used. It wasn't, we have to be innovative. You know, everybody just was innovative. And so, I don't know if we put it in the water or in something, but we definitely recruited those types of people. And if I think about what would be an ideal culture or an ideal way almost of leading, innovation, I whether you're a male or a female leader, I think you can crack it if you can make innovation just part of the way in which you lead and the way in which your team delivers, as opposed to making it a thing.
Can you explain that a little bit more? Like, do you have an example, practical, where you've seen this in action?
Yeah. So as I said to you, in those businesses in the early days, and still in many startups that I work with today, people don't really talk about innovation. I think there's an acknowledgement that the companies, there are lots of good ideas out there, but the ones that win are the ones who get there first. So a lot of innovation can happen, but if you don't get there first, you lose, right? And so everything that I see is today in startups and in those companies I mentioned to you before is people have innovation in their DNA, but they're also able to move very quickly and that drive for competition. If I look at traditional businesses, I think you might, for some instances, so we work together, you know, the whole energy, RWE, history, transition, embracing innovation. I think if you were in a traditional company, you probably need to create a vehicle and be explicit about the fact that you want to do innovation because it doesn't, you know, those companies were still innovative, But if you want to create disruptive innovation and new business models, you probably need to create, right? And use it as a word and give it a certain focus for a period of time. But what I have seen in, I'm thinking of some engineering businesses I work with, that what they've done is they start with this notion of we have an entity, we're going to create an innovation team, but their success is anchored in only doing that for a finite period of time, really focusing on building that into the culture, and then it just becomes another way in which business is done.
Mm-hmm. What was the particular challenge? You talked about the old businesses like Energy Creation in Germany or RWE is 120 years old with a I don't want to say old culture. Of course, culture is always moving and changing, etc. Yeah. But with the culture that it had at that time as a big corporate in Germany, and what was the main challenge to inject a little bit of innovation?
I think a couple of things. I think fear of change, fear of failure, fear of the unknown. We've always done it this way. Why should we change? We're big and we're fairly successful. We've been there for a long time. Why change? I think all of those good things. I think also having recruited maybe people in the same mold for a long period of time, some leaders tend to hire in their own mold. That created issues. So there was, you know, we were all the same and not enough diverse thinking. But like I said to you, I think we need to distinguish between, as you know, right, Horizon 1 and 2 innovation, which is about the core of what we are and who we are. And I think even businesses like RWE or Energy at the time, they were still great at their core innovation. But I think when it comes to disruptive innovation, you see more fear. Disruptive innovation, which could see their own business model destroyed, which could see, you know, them not be there in the future as leaders. I think that's where you start seeing the fear and the not invented here syndrome emerges.
Yeah. And the decision was at that time to create a unit for innovation, the Innovation Hub.
Yeah.
And of course, an alternative would be to try to make every team a little bit more innovative and then see which teams are actually, you know, taking it on and really making a good step forward with it. Why was it chosen, or why was the choice to make a unit out of it?
I think because the core business wasn't ready. There was a big piece, I mean, I think you might know as well, right? A big piece of cultural work done, readiness work to get the broader business ready, because it was such a big mothership ready for innovation. But you can't be quick enough, particularly not if we're looking at the future of energy, which is what the Innovation Hub looked at, this, you know, creating new business models for our future. It would have taken too long if we tried to turn the oil tanker or the mothership around. And so a small, nimble unit with very different ways of working, with different leadership models, with different partnerships, still anchored within the mothership and always with the brief of connecting back into the core business. One of the key principles, rules we had a lot of freedom, but one of our five, what we called hard rules, was we always have to do whatever it is commercially, something that can influence and change the culture in the mothership. And so, you know, I think it was an acknowledgement that you couldn't change a big legacy business, and in some places you didn't need to change it, but that you also needed to protect innovation, put a little fence around it and allow the seeds to grow, because otherwise, unintentionally or intentionally, you could stifle it.
Mm-hmm. Would you say there's a difference in how female leaders would manage innovation versus male leaders?
Mm-hmm. I'd say most female leaders, in my view, are really... You know, it's not about the ideas that they have from an innovation perspective. It's more in how, like you say, how they lead, right? So they have a more, most of the ones, and we can't generalize that I know, have more of an openness towards and a tolerance for failing. So I think in the context of innovation, emotional intelligence is super important and often underrated. And giving people that psychological safety that you can experiment, you can try, you know, if you get it wrong, it's actually not a bad thing, obviously, provided you don't keep getting it wrong. But I think from a female leadership perspective, I certainly think some of the women that I have observed in the innovation space who really tap into their emotional intelligence, create psychological safety, and do so much quicker, they have teams who fail fast, and are willing to go the extra mile. Mm-hmm.
Is there an example where you would say you've seen female leadership leading innovation in a very nice way? Can you share some details?
Obviously I can't mention company names, but I would think of actually a female leader in the talent space and she sits at board level, who recognized the importance of what I say to you there, right? That it's a very traditional business. It needs to change. And what she recognized was only men on the board. Her first and primary focus, if the company was going to become both more digital and innovative, was to work at pace to change the composition of the board. And not by pushing anybody out, but by really being very innovative in how she brought advisors along, or, you know, got women ready within a 3-year period to step into the board. Mm-hmm. And that company now is recognized. It's an international business based out of the UK, been super successful, but it has a board now with the majority of women on the board, which is highly, highly, highly unusual. And no one questions it. It is this whole change and transition happened. It's commercially super successful. But she was very planful. She did it in a very creative way. As she could have gone and said, like, look, we have to have women on the boards and just push for that. Because obviously then from board level, that goes into executive leadership level and so on. But what she did was to have a very thoughtful way of, you know, creating the ground for it. And instead of pushing directly, she innovated around how she brought different perspectives in, which then over time, when board positions became open, the natural discussion by the chairman and the CEO of the company was, well, why do we need to go elsewhere? We've been exposed to all these amazing women. Why don't we choose one of them to step mm-hmm. onto the board? So I think that's one example, that I think has had an impact, not only in the innovation context, but actually that company's commercial performance during COVID.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like a very well thought through master plan in the transition. Mm-hmm. So just to see whether I understood it correctly, there was no change at the beginning in the board composition, right? It was still a pretty male dominated board.
100% male.
100% male, okay. But she brought in experts or advisors who were female and then who just participated in board sessions as guests at the beginning?
Exactly, exactly, exactly. And then, you know, the traditional board went, oh, they're not that strange, these women. Maybe we could have a few of them as board members.
Okay, and where did they come from? I mean, of course, this probably took a few months or maybe even years.
3 years.
3 years, okay. And within 3 years, you can bring up some, you know, good female leaders more seniority space, being able to run boards as well.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Very nice. And we talked about now innovation and transition. Is there in general, would you say that in general there's a difference between female leadership and male leadership?
I think it's less and less so mm-hmm. now. I think the world has changed. I think it's, you know, we can now add a whole other dimension to all of this, right? Not only male leadership and female leadership, but, you know, the whole LGBTQ+ spectrum of leadership. Mm-hmm. But going back to what I'm seeing is, and maybe it's an effect of COVID, but I think the gap between the male and the female leadership is close, is not so big or is not so wide, where I see people lead businesses from a human perspective, mm-hmm. The human perspective being either putting the employees first or putting the customer first, where that doesn't happen, and putting their own ego out the way. But I think That's where I've seen the gap close and the least differences, where I see leaders who really put people first, as I said. Mm-hmm. Where I see the biggest gaps still in traditional businesses, mm-hmm. right?
And you just talked about it earlier, right, where you had a discussion about why not injecting female board members. What is, I mean, as you say, some male and female have probably learned to work together better and to yeah. concentrate more on the human side of business. What happens to those old businesses, or what does not happen to them so that they still are stuck in the old thinking methods?
They are. And I have a view. I think it's so difficult because the easy answer would be to say to you, oh, they'll fail and they're not going to be successful. But the world is much more complicated. And this point goes back to my earlier point around realistic conversations with particularly younger women, which is you can have almost everything, but not everything. Because I also would say that what I've seen in the last few years is I'm still more often than not the only woman in board discussions or in senior leadership meetings. Mm-hmm. And in particularly in traditional businesses, some of them have chosen to embrace the new, and some of them have gone completely back to, you know, pulling a fence around them and saying in this new uncertain world, we should rather hold on to the way in which we do things and have done things with the people who we, you know, trust and have gone to school and university with and who are typically just male. Mm-hmm. Whereas I see some other businesses have changed. So if you ask me, am I hopeful at the moment about the topic of, I think there has been an evolution. What I'm really positive about is that I'm seeing glimmers of, you know, leaders, male and female, that focus on humans, where I see progress. The piece that makes me really a little bit disappointed is I also see, particularly in traditional sectors, that complete step back. And whether that's been triggered by the macroeconomics, the macro political crisis, etc., traditional leaders retreat in those times and want to work with the ones they know and are much less open to be tolerant for new ways of thinking and leading, and particularly from women.
Mm-hmm. Well, they do have a comfort zone also in terms of leading, right, which has worked in the past mm-hmm. years. And then maybe COVID has brought a little bit of opening up because people now had to go to the home office and work from there. And I assume that many of the traditional leaders would not have liked that too much, at least the ones I've observed. Always thought home office was like, a mini holiday.
You're not working when you're in the home
office. You're not working. You're doing fun stuff and you're playing
washing,
around.
Having some food, you're going to the fridge.
All the time. And I think all leaders have learned that this is not necessarily the case. And that actually home office work can be a very productive type of work if done well. But the funny thing is, now with the crisis that we see, you know, glimpses of crisis, economic, banking, as well as on the war front, unfortunately, you're turning back to your old style, right?
Unfortunately.
That's really unfortunate. The pandemic has opened up things, but other crises seem to rather tighten things again towards the old styles. Is there any kind of scenario that you see that these kind of boards would be able to open up and be more flexible about their leadership styles?
Because I do think some of them are not going to be successful in attracting talent, in attracting the right customers, engaging their customers in the right ways if they keep doing, they've done things in the past. And unfortunately, though, I think in these types of situations, there needs to be commercial pain and failure mm-hmm. before people go, okay, maybe we need to be innovative and try and do things differently. And maybe we need other people to help us lead through this period of change. And maybe we need people who don't come from the same backgrounds that we come from. So I think I whilst I am an optimist at heart, I think people often, you know, it's like with coaching. If someone doesn't want to be coached, the coaching relationship won't work. Mm-hmm. They want to have it. And similarly, there's normally an experience that triggers that. And I think the same would need to happen for some of those leaders.
But what you're saying is there is an economic risk for those companies who are dominated by male kind of traditional leaders that they will fail over time.
Definitely. Definitely. Mm. Definitely. I don't doubt that for a second.
But talking about female leadership again, the you talked about innovation and the emotional intelligence and also the more appetite for risk, or, you know, being more courageous. Is that something that has to do with the old role of a mother who needs to, on the one hand side, understand the husband, the male, the community, the children, et cetera, et cetera? Or is it just anything that is in the DNA or so?
I think women are amazing. I think they are able to do all those things you say and more. And I think where it comes from, you know, even if you look at South Africa and all the political changes that happened, whilst women might not have been always out there protesting politically, they were the ones who were at home that looked after everyone, so that, you know, their husbands, sons, whoever could be in a position to go out there, they were often the ones who, you know, kept the family going. So I think, you know, at the risk of generalizing, I do think women have this innate ability to cover multiple bases. They have to, in this day and age still, and that goes back again to my topic of we should have a realistic conversation. And so, you know, but over time, I hope that women who are responsible for sons will make sure that they pass these things on to their sons, so that it's not just women in future who, you know, have this innate ability. Because at the end of the day, mothers who have sons have a big responsibility to help drive the change.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like it might go away a little bit as the roles fade out, or as the roles become a bit more colorful, let's put it that way, as also more male are than the full-time parent, so to speak. And over time, this might then just come to a natural mixture between male and female.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's my hope. That's my hope.
Is there anything we can do as a society, like politically or so, to help that development move along?
I think what we can do is a realistic conversation and talk to mothers about their responsibility in making these changes happen. And then women holding each other accountable, as opposed to standing on the side and saying men are like that or male leaders are like this. Well, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. How are you helping solve? How are you creating the next generation? And how are you bringing male and females leaders closer together?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, you do a lot of coaching and advisory these days, and Purple Beach is, of course, your main vehicle for the consultancy bit. May I ask the stupid question, how do you come up with this name, Purple Beach? It sounds like an agency for vacations or holidays.
Yeah. No, it's a good way. It's a good way, a good, maybe like a bow around everything we spoke about. So for me, Purple Beach, as I mentioned to you in the beginning, I have a huge amount of passion for creativity, but then there's pragmatism as well. So the color purple is a combination of red and blue, red being passion, creativity, blue being structured and analytical. And if you combine them, you create purple, which is a higher order color that helps you dream, that's aspirational. And a beach is never the same, constantly changing. You meet super interesting people on a beach that you never think you would meet. You can create the time to reflect on a beach. And so for me, this notion of Purple Beach is all about a space, or when we work with leaders, we create the space for them to acknowledge and get in touch again with their creativity, but actually through real pragmatism, then achieve what they want to achieve, you know, not only for their company, but for themselves, and hopefully so change the world.
Mm-hmm. Coming back now to the work you do, what was in your 10 years and more of this work, what was the weirdest question you were asked, or the weirdest task that you had to perform?
Oh, there are many, many that I can't even mention on here. So, the weirdest question... I still find it odd being asked, and maybe people are just interesting or curious, the weirdest question is people don't say to me, where are you from? Which I think some people can take offense, but I get asked, what's that accent that you have? And I'm like, I get it. But for me, it's a strange question because it's almost like ask me directly where I'm from, or maybe I do have a strange accent. I don't know. But I think that's the weirdest question that I consistently get asked.
Okay. That's I didn't expect that answer, but fair enough.
Exactly. There you go.
Yeah. No, but that was my first question as well. Where are people coming from? Because wherever you come from is a big element of your heritage, of your cultural heritage, your education, etc. So it's in you. And of course, you can always change and direction, etc. But it's still, it's always a part of you, right? Now, if we have these, as you say at the beginning, if you have now some of the listeners who want to change the world, now knowing that it's not possible all at once and maybe not everything, but what would be kind of the hint or the tip you would give to someone, who wants to change the world and wants to become a leader, female leader, maybe?
One step at a time. And start with the people closest to you, the community you're in. Take accountability for making a difference there, and help. So if I'm talking about female leadership, open doors for other female leaders, be there for them. Develop other women, never accept the status quo, but always start small. Because I think if you start small, you have the better opportunity to have small wins. And the small wins add up to big wins. I walked the Great Wall of China for a couple of years ago, and no one told me it doesn't look like you see on television, right? It's not like all fancy and nice. You have to climb up and then you have to walk over broken walls, and it's quite dangerous. And we walked and you really have to be careful not to fall. And I think that what I learned on that trip, and it's so true in life, is I looked down when we had a break. I looked up and I could see the horizon of where we were going. But I literally, if you didn't take one step at a time, literally one step at a time, tiny steps, you could fall. But what that taught me is, at the end of the day, every day, 35 kilometers done.
Because I like this view of the Chinese wall being a huge building, being a huge success also of mankind. Mm-hmm. But if you walk it, every step counts, right? And if you do one wrong step, it might be not going further. Which takes me to the question, do you feel you've made wrong steps? And how did you deal with them? Or can you maybe share one example?
I think the usual ones, which is not when starting to lead people in the beginning, maybe having too much compassion and not dealing with issues quick enough because I wasn't brave enough. And we all know, right? Mm-hmm. Even that's the advice I now give. Deal with challenges, whether people or other, very quickly, because at the end of the day, if it's a people challenge, it's actually unkind towards the people who then get stressed. And it's much better just to deal with people challenges quickly. So I made some of those mistakes some other mistakes I made was, in those early businesses. So for instance, Skype was one of them. We really needed a lot of talent very quickly. I compromised on quality, so quantity over quality, bums on seats versus, preparing the ground, never compromising, holding out. Oh, what else have I made? I've made so many mistakes. I think it was a mistake going to live in Switzerland, but I'm happy I did it.
Why? What did you not like about that?
It's a bit boring for me. I can't generalize. but I was... I'm sorry, it was a little bit boring. and I was very lonely. I was very lonely coming from a big, a country with summer and sun and friends and very, very different country, right? Culturally, etc. Whereas coming to the UK was very easy. It was an old colony. It's very similar. It's the products are the same. But sometimes I wonder if I didn't go to Switzerland, would have been so happy in the UK. So that's another mistake, but that mistake was a positive one because it brought me here.
Yeah, that was my next question. How do you deal with these mistakes? I mean, at some point in time, you realize, that wasn't good. That was a mistake. That wasn't clever. What happens then to you? How do you feel about it? And how do you live with these mistakes?
I think in the beginning, I would be devastated and I would take myself, you know, too seriously. And I would, you know, be very hard on myself. I think what I now try and do is spot patterns of behavior. So what am I doing again? Why am I doing it? What's happening in this situation? And to just, I often say to myself, okay, before you are hard on yourself, what would you say to your best friend if they were in this situation? So I think I'm a little bit kinder on myself now, although I can still be quite hard.
Yeah. Is there a notion of sometimes you realize this is just a part of me, it's just a character trait, and I can't, even if I want it, I can't easily change it?
Yeah. There's that. But I also often, I'm quite cautious not to say, use that as an excuse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there are certain things in you that you just can't change, and you'll keep making those mistakes. And maybe it's, someone gave me a very helpful frame, which is, it's not about right and wrong. It's not about constantly moving forward, but it's actually about evolving. So, I mean, mm-hmm. How did you put it? It's like a spiral that's going upwards. And, you know, you should view it like that, as opposed to black and white, right and wrong, good and bad. So that's a helpful frame as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think the worst is if you don't do something about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, right. If you now had to pick a CEO or a board member, what would be the most important value that you would look after?
Open-mindedness and fairness. I think those two. Because if you're open-minded, that means you probably don't have a big ego. You're self-aware. And fairness, again, no ego. You're able to do objectively what is right and treat every situation and people for who they are. And you would drive for fair outcomes versus winning or losing.
Mm-hmm. And would you in general prefer female over male candidates?
So would I choose female or male candidates? Obviously female candidates, because we still have a huge mountain to climb in terms of making organizations, especially at the top, more representative. But I can't generalize. If there is an amazing male candidate or, you know, LGBTQ+, then I'm open. But my preference would be to fight the battle that needs to be fought around more women in leadership roles and boards.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Beautiful. Thanks a lot for that. And actually, the music is sneaking in again for us. So that tells us the time is over. Maybe as a last question on this one, what was the most moving moments in this podcast for you?
When you asked me where I'd want to retire and I could save the sea.
Which is where you are living now. So is that the place you want to retire?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes, 100%.
But it's not the time to retire now. There's so much more work to do, right?
I don't know. It depends on the day that you ask me.
Okay. It's not a good question for a Friday, right?
No. But thank you very much, Marcus. I really enjoyed this.
Annemie, thanks a lot for your time again, and have a good weekend. Hopefully not a too stressful rest of the Friday. And also thanks a lot to everyone else who has listened to this call. Please share it. Put comments in Spotify, Apple, wherever you are listening to it. That would be great. Thanks a lot and have a good weekend. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.